going to be in Matthew chapter 9, verses 14 to 17. And when you're ready, church, would you stand for the reading of God's word? Then John's disciples came and asked him, "How is it that we and the Pharisees fast often, but your disciples do not fast?" Jesus answered, "How can the guests of the bridegroom mourn while he is with them? The time will come when the bridegroom will be taken from them. Then they will fast. No one sews a patch of unshrunk cloth on an old garment, for the patch will pull away from the garment, making the tear worse. Neither do people pour new wine into old wineskins. If they do, the skins will burst, the wine will run out, and the wineskins will be ruined. No, they pour new wine into new wineskins, and both are preserved." This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. U2 is one of the most successful rock and roll bands in history. They're also followers of Jesus of Nazareth and have been since the charismatic renewal swept through the church in the United Kingdom, and that included the youth group that they attended when they were teenagers and set their hearts on fire for Jesus in a way that's never gone out. In fact, they almost never recorded a single song. The Edge met with the band, telling them he was going to quit to become a Christian missionary just before their first album was released. It took weeks, but Bono eventually talked him into at least recording the first album with them before he took off, and the rest, as they say, is history. They did not find a way to play stadiums instead of serve the poor, though. They found a way to inhabit both vocations. In 1979, U2 performed in an event benefiting Amnesty International, which is an organization fighting global poverty and injustice, leaving an indelible mark on the whole band, but Bono in particular. In 1986, he then traveled to Ethiopia with World Vision, where he sat down emotionally moved by the lives of those within the village where he was serving and wrote the lyrics to "Where the Streets Have No Name," which is a prayer for heaven to come to earth right there in that Ethiopian village. Around that same time, as a young man, Bono said, "I can't change the world, but I can change the world inside of me." And then he devoted his life to making the world inside of him a place where heaven touches earth. He went on to be an advocate and contributor to multiple music festivals benefiting the global poor. He co-founded Live 8, which is the most successful such festival by far. And then he co-founded a nonprofit organization called One, whose mission is to bring an end to global poverty. He has lobbied with many governments, holding meetings with multiple U.S. presidents to benefit the global poor. He's called on the church, meeting also with renowned pastors of large congregations throughout America and the Western world, advocating for the church to be found where Jesus promises to be found among the poor. Bono's a man who has done his best to spend his fame on the least of these. He's used his voice to contend for an end to global poverty. He's given his life in mission to see Jesus' kingdom come. "I can't change the world, but I can change the world inside of me." But in his memoir, which was published just about a year ago, he writes, not as a young man, but later, somewhere in the second half of his life, "I can change the world, but I can't change the world inside of me. Living missionally among the poor to whom I show up to serve, well, that's the easy part of apprenticeship to Jesus. The real battle, the place the deepest journey along the narrow way tends to happen, that's the invisible world inside of me." For him, it's the habit he has of drinking a little bit too much, and the way that he struggles to keep his feet on the ground among shame, and the struggle with how to be a good husband and father with the job that has him traveling so much, and the struggle to grieve his mother's death, and the struggle to forgive his father's mistakes. "I can't change the world, but I can change the world inside of me," he said as a young man. "Well, I can change the world, but I can't change the world inside of me," he humbly surrendered as an old man. And Bono divides his entire life just by those two statements, and I can identify with that. In my 36 years, I've had the privilege of apprenticing with Jesus into service among the addicted, the imprisoned, the impoverished, the orphan, the houseless, and the widow. Through trial and error, I have fought for the renewal of the world with this one life that I have got. But the battles that have and continue to wrestle me to the ground, those are the internal ones. The thought patterns and habits, the ways I respond to stress, my propensity to live in the future rather than the present, the parts of my marriage and my parenting and my closest friendships that I can't seem to get right, the past pain that keeps on informing my present, the misaligned priorities and that incessant need to grab for control that I can never get my hands on. Receiving the victory of Jesus that was won on the cross is a journey all on its own. And many of us have a story of when we dropped our nets and followed behind him. The world inside of me coming into alignment with that victory Jesus won on the cross, that's another story. A story of a different type. One that I can't tell so neatly in a script and tie a bow on top of at the end. It's one that I'm still very much in the thick of, pulling apart the layers of conflict as I wrestle with today, and I will keep on wrestling with all the way until I pass from this age into the one to come. I can change the world, but I can't change the world inside of me. Yeah, I know exactly what he's talking about, and I'm guessing I'm not the only one. Unforced Rhythms of Grace, 9 Core Practices for a Rule of Life. This whole teaching series has been addressing that second journey, the world inside of me kind of journey. And we have now covered the 9 practices. And the truth that we are confronting this morning as our series begins to draw to a close is this: to live a vision continuously requires a vow, or what has been known throughout Christian history as a rule of life. And I simply want to talk about the what, why, and how. So first, what is a rule of life? Why do we need it? And then how do we live it? And for that, we return to Matthew chapter 9. Neither do people pour new wine into old wineskins. If they do, the skins will burst, the wine will run out, and the wineskins will be ruined. No, they pour new wine into new wineskins, and both are preserved. Now, while a full exegesis of this passage would require a deep dive into Jewish rabbinical debates, to cut right to the chase for our purposes today, according to Jesus, if we fail to perceive, 1, what God is doing in our time, and 2, the proper container to hold the outpoured blessing of God, the result is a double loss. The wine is spilled, meaning the gift of God's presence and power for his people is wasted, and the wineskins burst. The container for holding God's previous blessing, useful at another time, are left tattered and broken by trying to hold this new wine. A young Christ follower who had converted from Islam then started leading a Bible study among his friends, and he led hundreds, literally hundreds, to Jesus. This group then began to grow and meet together, and there was a bit of a Book of Acts story unfolding among them, and then a very well-intentioned local pastor got involved, and he offered his church's home group structure as a container within which that group of new converts could continue to flourish. But when he tried to fit those couple hundred new believers into his church, a small group structure, the momentum stopped, the young leaders were sidelined, and within a year, many of those new believers had walked away from the Christian faith altogether. By trying to fit new wine into an old wineskin, the wine was spilled and the wineskin burst. It hurt the fresh work God was doing among this Muslim convert community, and it hurt the local church with faithful members in those small groups. Do you see it? Do you see what I'm saying? This is what Jesus was cautioning against. But unlike some of Jesus' teaching, he does not make this point in the midst of a formal moment of teaching or a clever parable. Jesus said this in response to a question. Then John's disciples came and asked him, "How is it that we and the Pharisees fast often, but your disciples do not fast?" In other words, we notice subtle differences between apprenticeship to Jesus and apprenticeship to John the Baptist. So what does it mean to apprentice under you, Jesus, versus under John? What are your practices? What are your vows? These are disciples of John the Baptist. They're curious friends, not agitated opponents. They're saying something like, "We like your vision, but how do you live your vision continuously? We like your wine. What's your wineskin? What is the vow by which you express your vision?" Marriage is the only context for vows we've got left in Western culture. And as a licensed wedding officiant, I can tell you that you can have any kind of wedding ceremony you want, but if you do not speak vows at some point, I can't sign the papers. Isn't that interesting? I love you and you love me. We're in love. Why formalize something as fiery and organic as love with something as drab and old time as vows? Because to live a vision continuously, like a fire of love that is so alive in our hearts today, that requires a vow for the inevitable ups and downs of life that are going to follow this day. That's the fact we're acknowledging every time we say, for better or worse, for richer or poorer, until death do us part. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, when he was officiating a wedding, offered this famous piece of advice to the young couple. Today you are young and very much in love, and you think your love can sustain your marriage. It can't. Let your marriage sustain your love. See, Bonhoeffer's looking at these two people with the fire of love inside their hearts for one another. Nothing matters except this person. Every other plan is out the window from this day forward. And he's saying something like, love the vision. And I see that you really believe it, that you really want it, so you're gonna need a vow. Vows are the container that hold a vision where it can flourish. They're like the proper pot for a plant, one with just the right soil and the right amount of space for the roots to grow, a container where the seed can be planted so that it can reach its full fruitful potential. That's what a vow does for a vision. It holds it in the proper container so that it can grow and flourish. New York Times columnist and author David Brooks, he defines commitment as falling in love with something or someone and then building a structure of behavior around it for those moments when love falters. To live a vision continuously requires a vow. Now, of course, it should be noted that every commitment we make to God is always in response to the covenant that he has made to us. Every expression of love we offer back to God is only a response to his love to us. We love because he first loved us. But also, human vows to God in response to his covenant to us are equally biblical. I mean, Numbers chapter 6 details the Nazarite vow, which is a committed rule of life by which some lived by the purification rites of the high priest to enter the Holy of Holies continually, meaning their lives were made into a living reminder to all of God's people of the nearness of his presence to them. And in Acts chapter 21, it indicates that while pastoring in Corinth, the apostle Paul lived by the Nazarite vow, meaning he committed himself to a set of practices regarding his fasting, his dress, his purity, all for the sake of union with Jesus at a critical juncture in his ministry. So if the apostle Paul, the most bullish proponent of grace and destroyer of legalism, made vows to God, that's probably as strong a biblical endorsement as we can get. The Catholic Encyclopedia defines the term vow as an act of generosity toward God. It is the means by which we give God the only thing that we have to give him, which is more of our own inner lives, more real estate within us for him to work out his transformation in. A vow, or a rule of life, as it's more commonly called, is never a means to make God love you more or to prove your commitment to him. It is the means by which we offer God more of ourselves to work with. It's love, not legalism or fear, that drives us to make vows to a spouse. And it is love, not legalism or fear, but love and love only and love always that drives us to make vows to God. Psalm 56, I am under vows to you, my God. I will present my thank offerings to you, for you have delivered me from death and my feet from stumbling, that I may walk before God in the light of life. Under vows to my God? Why? That I may walk before God in the light of life. Vows are how we learn to live in the promised land when we grew up in Egypt. I can change the world, but I can't change the world inside of me. God's redemption within each one of us is so comprehensive that it includes both the fruitfulness of our outer lives and the renewal of the world around us by his love, and the internal rewiring of our soul's deepest and most injured places by that same love. And the ancient practice of a rule of life is the container that we can allow the vision of being with Jesus, becoming like Jesus, and doing what Jesus did to flourish in me and you. It's how we live this vision continuously in the world, outside and inside of me. It is the wineskin that holds this wine. So what is a rule of life? Because I'm guessing that terminology is quite new to a number of us. Well, I want to answer that question in the most straightforward way I know how, through three different lenses: biblically, historically, and practically, in that order. So first, what is a rule of life biblically? Well, in the Hebrew Bible, or what we commonly call the Old Testament, we see a rule of life in number 6, the Nazarite vow that I referenced a moment ago, which was taken by some within Israel. But we also see a rule of life that guides and guards the whole community, given by God through Moses in Exodus. God prescribes festivals, practices, and rituals for all of his people, fasting and abstinence, prayers and pilgrimage, feasting and worship. It is a rule of life, a set of practices by which we live the vision of covenant to him continuously. Then in the New Testament, we see a rule of life in Acts 21 when Paul took the Nazarite vow, indicating that there are in fact moments when the apostles perceived an invitation from God to a particular vow for living out the vision of the body of Christ in community. But we also see that a rule of life guides and guards the whole community that is given by God through the Spirit at Pentecost. The famous passage that summarizes early church life at the close of Acts 2 is a set of countercultural practices observed by all within the community. They're gathering and breaking bread, they're receiving teaching and meeting each other's practical needs, they're worshiping and praying. Interestingly, at the close of Acts 2, when we read, they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer. That word prayer is rendered singular in our English translations, but it's actually plural in Greek. It literally says the breaking of bread and to the prayers, a reference to the 3 times a day daily prayer rhythm that anchored the life of the early church and which we're trying to revive here at Bridgetown Church. So Acts 2 opens with this great vision of the prophet Joel, God's people filled with God's Spirit, bringing God's kingdom to earth. And it culminates with the great vow of the early church, a way to live that vision continuously. There are times when the people of God in both the Old Testament and the New Testament perceived some sort of whole life set of practices for following Jesus in a particular time and place. And in between the Hebrew Bible and the early church, all of this comes together most profoundly in Jesus, who famously said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Let's break that statement down. I am the life, says Jesus. It was Aristotle who popularized the word telos for the ultimate aim of an individual life. And whatever your telos is the most determining factor about who you become. If you believe career success to be deeply satisfying and of ultimate purpose, then you will express that belief through certain priorities and practices aimed at ambition. On the other hand, if you believe fun and adventure to be deeply satisfying and of ultimate purpose, then you'll express that belief through a different set of priorities and practices aimed at adventure. Telos orders and aims everything else in your life. Jesus is saying here, I am the telos. I am the satisfying, full, abundant kind of life. And the pathway to the life of Jesus is the way and the truth. As the church formed around Jesus' life and teaching, that pathway was codified in the very technical but important terms orthodoxy and orthopraxy, or orthopraxis. Orthodoxy means what we believe. And orthopraxy refers to how we live or how we practice our belief. I am the truth, says Jesus. In tragic irony, it was those whose spiritual practices most nearly mirrored Jesus's, whose hearts were furthest from him. He reserved his harshest critique for the Pharisees for a carefully practiced faith devoid of belief in him as true Lord. I am the way, says Jesus. Or in John 7, he says something similar this way. Anyone who chooses to do the will of God will find out whether my teaching comes from God or whether I speak on my own. In other words, Jesus is saying, if you want to know if my teachings are true, try them. The earliest Christians were called followers of the way because they were primarily known for their countercultural lifestyle, their orthopraxy. So, practice without belief does not result in true life, right? Some are drawn to Jesus' lifestyle while rejecting his truth claims as Lord and Savior. They want the kingdom without the king. But belief without practice also does not result in true life. Others are drawn to Jesus' teaching, formulating it into doctrine, but their lives still are shaped more by American culture than they are by Jesus of Nazareth. They want the king without the kingdom. The equation that Jesus seems to be putting forth in this passage is the way of Jesus plus the truth of Jesus equals the life of Jesus. So how do we hold these two together, orthodoxy and orthopraxy, not just celebrating allegiance to Jesus' truth claims, but ordering our lives in such a way that we become like him, a rule of life? Now let's take a look at rule of life historically. Rule of life is not a new idea, it's an ancient one. Its origins go all the way back to the 4th and 5th century Celtic movement, but many believe it predates even them, tracing it all the way back to the desert fathers and mothers. And in the early days, the terms way of life and rule of life were used interchangeably. Way of life is the English translation of the Greek terminology. Rule of life is the English translation of the Latin. And over time, as Latin became the universal language, rule of life won out in Christian communities across the globe. And I know you hate that. You so would have preferred for way of life to be the common terminology of this historic practice, because you are a 21st century Westerner who hates words like rule, not a 4th century Middle Easterner who wasn't really put off by it at all. And I totally get that. And I would sincerely counsel all of you feeling that way to just relax. You see, we use the word rule to mean a list of do's and don'ts today, right? We use it in its plural form. Follow the rules or you'll get in trouble. But we're talking here about rule in the singular form, rule of life, not rules for life. Rule comes from the Latin regula, from which we get the English words regular and ruler. Ruler as in an instrument for drawing a straight line. When we say rule of life, we mean an instrument for drawing a straight line between you and your telos, a straight line between you and life at its most abundant and full. Also note that we are saying rule, not law. Laws are handed down to us, imposed on us by another. Rules, the ancient understanding of this term, are discovered and chosen by an individual. Laws keep us away from the negative, think speed limit. Rules draw us near to the positive. Jesus, for instance, lived by a rule. Come to me and I'll give you rest for your souls. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me. My yoke is easy and my burden is light. Jesus did not say, come to me and live however you want. He's got a yoke. He is very upfront about that fact, but he's an invitational teacher and the invitation is good. It is toward rest for your soul and a light burden. That is a rule. Every monastic movement in church history, every last one of them, decided at some point along the way that they needed a rule of life. This has made its way into the traditions of the mystics, Catholics, Protestants, evangelicals, and the world of spiritual formation. You will find rule of life in modern writings from people like Dallas Willard, Pete Scazzaro, Ruth Haley Barton, Rich Belotus, Richard Foster, Marjorie Thompson, and Robert Mulholland, just to name a few. Pretty much every robust Christian discipleship group, cohort, or community culminates in the creation of a rule of life. All to say, this is not a practice for believers of a certain personality type or stage of life. This is a historic Christian practice traced all the way back to the earliest communities. Now, finally, and most importantly, rule of life practically. Traditionally, a rule of life has been understood through the image of a trellis. Some scholars even argue that the language is historically connected to this image. We don't know for sure. What we do know for sure is that trellis was the metaphor used by the early teachers to illustrate a rule of life. Now, if you were to drive about 40 minutes from here, you'd find yourself in wine country. And if you walk through any vineyard, you will notice that every grapevine will be growing on a trellis. Why is that? Because a grapevine allowed just to grow on the ground wildly will bear fruit, but not to its fullest potential. Given a form to support its growth, it will become even more fruitful, to borrow the language of Jesus from John 15. This is how the ancients described a rule of life. It is a trellis that supports us as we remain connected to the true vine, that we might be even more fruitful. That's what a rule of life is. A rule of life is a way of making all of your life a response to the Spirit's invitations. Or if you prefer, it's a way of making all of your life into a spiritual practice. Anything can be a spiritual practice. We've given you 9 core practices, which you should think of like the major food groups in a healthy spiritual diet. Like if you were to imagine a food guide pyramid, which I know is an out-of-date reference, and all of you are either eating only meat or never meat under any circumstances. But the truth is you're thinking about carbs and indulging in carbs secretly from time to time. But if you were to imagine the ancient advice that is the food guide pyramid, it was given to offer daily guidance toward a healthy diet. And that's what we're trying to do in this teaching series through these 9 practices, is offer general guidance on a healthy spiritual diet. But the truth is that anything can be a spiritual practice, like Bible reading or a Saturday stroll, solitary prayer or laughter with friends, contemplative silence in the morning, and a glass of wine in the evening. So what makes something a spiritual practice then? It's just this: connecting the gift to the giver. And that tends to be a whole lot easier with things like scripture and prayer and silence. So I would say that those are the absolute essentials, the major food groups to a healthy spiritual diet. But when you pour a glass of wine on the Sabbath and that first sip reminds you of the coming feast that you are promised to sit down at for all time with King Jesus, that is a spiritual practice. And when you walk slowly enough on a Saturday to notice all that you miss in the frenzy of the work week and see natural creation or the city around you bursting with the image of the Creator, that is a spiritual practice. Richard Foster defined spiritual practices as just a way of placing yourself where God can bless you. You see, spiritual practices are powerless in and of themselves. The power lies in the way they make you proximate to God's presence and the way that they open up your hands to receive his blessing. And because trellis isn't such a common image to all of us today as it was in the ancient world, I prefer to think about a rule of life as an anchor. An anchor holds a boat in a particular place because the sea is always moving. Right? If you were to go out on a boat today and drop anchor, you would not feel that anchor holding you where you intended to stay unless you've been drifting, right? And then you'd suddenly feel that jerk when the anchor tugs. A rule of life is meant to function in the same way. It is meant to be a set of practices that hold you in the place that God can bless you, and it doesn't feel strenuous. You don't feel it pulling at you unless you've begun to drift. Because the cultural currents beneath us and the changing winds of our circumstances are always pushing us and moving us around, usually too slowly for us to notice as it's happening. A rule of life anchors us to God's blessing, and we should only feel its tug when we've been drifting. Andy Crouch defines a rule of life as a set of practices that guard our hearts a set of practices to guard our habits and guide our lives. So if you would just humor me with this exercise. Close your eyes. And try to bring to mind and picture the person that you admire most. I'm talking about someone that you actually know, someone who pulls holiness out of you. Like just by their presence, when you're around them, it pulls the best version of you up to the surface. What is it about that person? How do you feel when you're around them? What does their presence communicate? Or what does their life say to you? And now, try to picture yourself at age 80. Some of you are there, so it won't be hard. Wow, hits later for some than others. Picture yourself at 80. Who do you want to be? How do you want people to feel when they're around you? What do you want to pull out of them? What does your presence communicate? What does your life say? And then lastly, and here's a question we're spending some time with, is how you are living today taking you where you want to go, forming you into who you want to become? I'm talking about your morning routine and your work hours, your weekend plans and your spiritual practices, your habits, everything from the way you spend the first 15 minutes of your morning to your diet to your typical weekday evening, your attention, like your media consumption, your reading and your listening and the free devotion of your imagination. Is all of it taking you there? Is it aimed exactly where you want to go, or is it slightly off center? And if you haven't already, come back to me now. Stephen Covey, he famously said, we achieve inner peace when our schedule is aligned with our values. So is your life a straight path to your telos? Or is it a very well-meaning, well-intentioned, but wandering journey? And maybe the even more important question than where is your path taking you is, what is your path doing to you as you go? Because there is no neutral in this world. You are being formed right now. There is only intentional spiritual formation and unintentional spiritual formation. So the way that you are living is forming who you become. And is it making you who you want to become, or is there a gap, maybe a troublingly wide gap, between your intention and your action? You see, the truth I'm getting at is that you already have a rule of life. Written or unwritten, chosen by you or chosen for you, conscious or unconscious, based on the kind of person you want to grow into, or based on the over-promising, under-delivering pleasure that you want to feel. The question is not, do you have a rule of life? The question is, do you know what your rule of life is? Because whatever's at the center for you isn't only taking you somewhere, it is forming you into its image. So I am not suggesting a new spiritual practice. I'm just suggesting attention and intention where you might have been inattentive or unintentional. One of the core problems with the human person is that our best intentions almost always outrun our actual lives. Right? Every one of us really means to be present, kind, easygoing, and that perfect balance of driven and relational. And every one of us will wake up one day to discover that we've become a certain kind of friend, a certain kind of spouse, a certain kind of parent, and a certain kind of teacher or chef or designer or real estate agent or pastor. There's a gap between who I intend to be and who I am, and that's where a rule of life lives. Right in the gap between intention and actual. So every Monday morning, I revisit my rule of life as a part of my time with God. When I first learned this practice, I was taught to construct a rule of life individually, and I was offered this four-part grid by a mentor: pray, rest, relationships, work. A grid that would simplify all the major areas of devotion in my life. And so every Monday morning, I sit silently in contemplative prayer, and then I read a psalm and another passage from Scripture, and I pray. And when it's Monday morning, my time of prayer involves re-examining my rule of life and considering the week I just lived and the week that I'm just about to live. And I read things like, pray, And under that banner, there's commitments like live by a daily prayer rhythm of morning, midday, and evening prayer along these invitations. And rest, where I have commitments to Sabbath and sleep and exercise. And relationships with set commitments for the quality time I want to spend with Kirsten, my wife. And the commitment to turn my phone off from 6 to 8 p.m. every day and to limit the number of evenings that I'm away from home to do something for a church commitment. And the reason I have those kind of commitments is because in 11 years, my 7-year-old son, Hank, he's gonna move out. And I won't care how this teaching went then. But I would give almost anything for one more Sunday night reading a book with 7-year-old Hank. So how can I live today in concert with who I want to become as I grow up as a father? I'm gonna need a set of vows to anchor me. Do you see what I'm saying? And then finally I get to work and I read statements like, I wanna be a pastor who prays. I wanna be a pastor who listens. I want to be a pastor who remembers the poor with committed practices for living each of those values into being beneath it. I read over that rule every Monday. I pray it into being. I plan it into my week. And then I live it the best I can, despite the fact that my intention on Monday morning every single week outruns my follow through in the 7 days that follow. Life is unpredictable and it's filled with interruption. We cannot plan our way to spiritual wholeness. What we can do, though, is put the big pieces in first, so that the work demands and the unexpected interruptions and the little abnormalities of every week fit around the Spirit's deepest transformation within us, rather than crowd it out. So my definition of a rule of life, if I had to offer you one, is this. It is a way of living today in line with my deepest desires and God's deepest transformation. A rule of life is not another thing to do. It's just an intentional way of thinking about all that you're already doing. And if you find that a rule of life is making you busier or speeding you up rather than slowing you down, or that a set of spiritual practices is making your life heavier rather than lighter, in all likelihood, you're working with a self-imposed rule, not a Spirit-led rule. A Spirit-led rule of life will always be more about subtraction than addition, because the vast majority of us are over busy. And so a rule of life will not add more on top of your already cluttered life. It will declutter so much of what you're already doing so that you can give yourself more purely to the essential. And the aim of every rule of life is joy. It is attuning to joy in the actual life that I'm living. A rule of life is not a spiritual fitness plan to whip you into shape. It is just wringing out the life that you've already got for everything that it's worth, so that you can attune to the Spirit in all the places that the Spirit is making his appeal to you. I want to become more radical in my old age to Jesus than I am right now. The aim of my life is to be increasingly radicalized to Jesus of Nazareth until I die and live in his face forever. But to get there, to become that, I gotta have a schedule that aligns with my values. I've got to live today pointed in that direction. I've got to have a straight line between me and my telos. I need a rule of life, because to live a vision continuously requires a vow. So that's what a rule of life is. Now that we know what it is, why do we need it? Why do we need a rule of life? By the 4th century, the Christian church was a phenomenon. This band of oppressed peasants had grown and grown until the Emperor Constantine, the most powerful man on the planet, named Christianity the official religion of the developing world. Out with the gladiatorial Greek gods, enough with pretending Roman Caesars are divine. This Jesus who we crucified is in fact Savior and Lord. It seemed like an astounding victory, but over time it turned out to be a subtle death blow. And that's because there's this obvious pattern in church history that the people of God always thrive in the worst conditions, but when the church buddies up with worldly power, it tends to lead to spiritual powerlessness. So the church that could not be stopped suddenly became diluted and watered down, and all the appetites of the surrounding world crept into the lives of the believers until they sang different songs, told a different story, had a different Sunday morning routine, but their lives were no different. And the whole movement of Jesus started to free fall just as fast as it had ascended. Some historians during this time began to predict the end of Christianity within their lifetimes. Why? Because the church was no longer getting into the empire. The empire was getting into the church. And can I just say, friends, That is absolutely our story. But the church didn't hit rock bottom in the fifth century. Life was breathed back into her when everyone wanted to leave her for dead. The community was revived. The potency of Jesus was preserved. And here we are. What happened to turn the tide? How did a diluted church recover her prophetic identity? A few ordinary radicals walked off into the desert. And we're pretty sure it started with this guy named Anthony in Egypt, but there was a movement of people, mostly unknown to each other, who returned to a simple life of prayer and the word. We know them today as the Christian Desert Fathers and Mothers. They walked off into the desert, mimicking Jesus at the beginning of his ministry, to stare down the idols of their time and allow the Spirit to form them into a prophetic contradiction. The result wasn't immediate, it was slow, but the result over time was life so compelling that people began to move out of cities to live this simple life around these desert fathers and mothers to be formed into their image. And this, from those communities, is where we get the terminology of rule of life. This didn't begin in abbeys or monasteries or with monks and nuns. It began with a few reformers who looked at a moment when the church was becoming diluted and said, "Not on my watch." In a time of chaos and compromise, when the church was losing the world and losing themselves, a few radicals protected the potency that she had at first, and then renewal flowed back into the church in the city from the desert. Above the surface, there was a renewal, but under the hood of all of that lived a vow. And that, my friends, is not an anomaly. That is a pattern. In the fifth century, Saint Benedict popularized the radical life of the desert fathers and mothers through the Benedictine rule. Later, Saint Francis and Saint Dominic both created equally disciplined but entirely different orders aimed at radical poverty and identification with the poor. Count Zinzendorf founded the global missions movement from a night and day prayer community in Germany, but it was the honorable order of the mustard seed, the rule of life by which he lived with others, that held the whole thing together. John Wesley had his heart strangely warmed. The vision of Jesus that captivated him was then formed into a vow called Wesley's Holy Club, ordered around 22 questions for introspection and accountability. Charles Finney, the revivalist of the Second Great Awakening in America, preached a farewell sermon in 1850, his final teaching entitled The Christian's Rule of Life. His final sermon was to live what we are experiencing now into maturity, to age this new wine into a fine vintage. We gotta have a vow. Mother Teresa served the poor in a way that woke up the sleepy church, and she ordered her personal life and her community around her humility list. Billy Graham filled stadiums for altar calls, and then he called a team together and created a shared rule of life in Modesto, California, later known as the Modesto Manifesto. You will find a rule of life at the heartbeats of saints from every persuasion and every tradition throughout church history. All of them above the surface stewarding renewals in the church, and all of them under the hood covenanted together in common vows expressed in local communities. Above the surface lived a renewal, under the hood lived a vow. And if you study all of these different movements, the rules that undergirded them in particular, you'll notice these three themes emerge, three patterns in every rule of life in church history. The first one is this: counterformation. Every rule of life is set up to intentionally contrast the cultural current of their time. One example of this is, one historian makes the case that when St. Francis founded his order, it was at the same time that the surrounding culture was moving from a trade economy to a money economy. So instead of, "Hey, I'll give you my bull for three of your sheep and a sack of flour," it was the possibility of wealth and accumulating money was there for the first time. And as a result, greed became more common and began to leak into the local church. So it was at that time in history that St. Francis said, "No, we have to set ourselves up against this idol that is diluting the way of Jesus." Therefore, we see the first vows of poverty ever made in church history at that very time. In the words of G.K. Chesterton, it is the paradox of history that each generation is converted by the saints who contradict it most. A rule of life should make us into a holy contradiction to the idols of our time. Secondly, it's always a minority of the church and never the majority. Meaning the aim of a rule of life was never to get everyone to do this stuff. The gift of a rule of life to the broader church was rather just that it created a deep end of the swimming pool. I've heard it said, the church is like a swimming pool. All the noise comes from the shallow end. The gift of a rule of life communally to the broader church is holy jealousy. It's just to have a few people swimming in the deep water saying to the rest of us, hey, come on in, swim deeper, the water's fine. And then third, a rule of life is always shared, never individualized. An individualized rule of life is where I started, and it is a phenomenal starting place. But an individualized rule of life is a somewhat diluted version of the full potency of this practice. So why a rule of life? Because if you look under the hood of the great renewal movements, you will discover again and again and again, ordinary people radically caught up in a vision, ordered by a rule of life to ensure that they live this vision continuously. To live a vision continuously requires a vow. The ancient practice of a rule of life is a way of living daily in the demands, needs, and obligations and opportunities of an individual life in step with the vision of the kingdom come in the world around me and the world inside of me. And this teaching series has been an invitation to a vision, the rediscovery of a whole life under the easy yoke of Jesus. So what is the wineskin to hold that wine? It's not a new wineskin, and it's not new wine. It's the ancient wine of the way of Jesus and the ancient wineskin of a rule of life. And we have been dreaming of having a rule of life shared at the heart of Bridgetown Church for years. In fact, for a couple of years before it was even on the table that I might end up in Portland, John Mark and I were collaborating on a shared rule of life between Bridgetown Church in Portland and Oaks Church Brooklyn, where I was leading in New York City at that time. We've been chipping away at this for years and inviting in a multitude of voices, people of different personality types and temperaments and stages of life and circumstances, but bound together by this shared vision. And the questions that we've been asking and been walking in are, what would a shared rule of life or a revived rule of life look like in our time? What might happen in our churches if there was a few swimming in the deep end, inviting the rest of us further? What might we see in the life of Jesus if we followed him not just in fits and starts, but in the ups and downs of life, girded by a set of vows? What might we steward as a renewal above the surface if beneath the hood we were living by a vow? And now, more than 5 years in the making, we are finally ready to set a rule of life at the center of our church and invite all those who feel led by the Spirit deeper to swim. The Bridgetown rule of life is anchored by the practices of prayer, scripture, solitude, fasting, Sabbath, community, generosity, service, and witness. That should sound familiar. It is the exact mirror image of the teaching series that we've just been walking through. All of this will be held together by a covenant community, meaning a group of people in a local church bound together by both orthodoxy and orthopraxy, by what we believe and by how we practice our belief, a community of learning and accountability who can draw from one another's journeys that help us to awaken our truest and most authentically redeemed selves. What we are dreaming of is desert fathers and mothers in the middle of the city. People of counterformation who don't retreat into the desert, but who live in the city under the rule of a different king, marching to the beat of a different kingdom. Kenneth Leach, in his book, True Prayer, he says, the desert has now moved into the heart of the city. We don't need to retreat to revive the church, but to stay and to live an alternative way in a contested place. Dietrich Bonhoeffer said, the restoration of the church will surely come from a sort of new monasticism, which has in common with the old only the uncompromising attitude of a life lived according to the Sermon on the Mount in the following of Christ. I believe it is now is the time to call people together to do this. And the Celtic historian Ian Bradley asks, could it be that in the postmodern pick and choose spiritual supermarket we now inhabit, people are actually craving commitment, discipline, and obedience? Why? because of the sober realization that to live a vision continuously requires a vow. And then finally, how do we do it? To be continued.
Important just for us to hear a little bit about what God's doing on the journey that he continues to be on. So I just want to ask a few questions. First, curious, Tyler, what this Lenten journey has been like for you, particularly in this moment and season of your life.
First, if you're new around here, I shared with the church, I get to serve as the lead pastor here, and I am midway through a cancer journey, and I'm in the midst of chemo treatment right now, and that has greatly informed my Lenten journey. We're in the season of Lent, which is a time of year where the church around the world identifies with the suffering of Christ, and I've observed the season of Lent through fasting and abstinence for 15 plus years now, each year, and what that has meant is that every year during this time, I try to get acquainted with Jesus in the midst of his suffering. And I have always chosen how I would do that. And this year has been very different. Fasting is a real spiritual pathway between me and God. It's one of the ways I connect with God the most. And here I am in a situation where it's medically strongly ill-advised for me to fast because of a whole bunch of things about the side effects of my treatment. And that was strange and a little bit disappointing to know I'm going to preach on fasting and invite everyone to fast, and then I'm going to not. And then Lent got started, and I found myself in the chemotherapy infusion unit of a hospital surrounded by suffering people, watching these nurses so patiently and attentively represent Jesus in the way that they dignified the suffering and the dying. And I have felt more acquainted with Jesus in his suffering than I think any Lenten journey that I've ever gotten to walk. And I have felt his love to me in a prolonged and unchosen season of weakness. You know, fasting is sort of this chosen weakness that I put my body through to identify with Christ. And then there's other times where weakness comes and finds us. And sometimes that's for a moment, and sometimes it's for a prolonged period. And one thing I know about weakness is that it opens me up to love in a way that strength or business as usual just doesn't. And I would say that I have experienced the love of God more profoundly and differently in this journey so far than other points in my life. And I would say that that weakness has made it possible for me to receive the love of God through other people in ways that have deeply marked me and represented Jesus. So that's my Lenten journey so far. Or no, there's one other thing that just popped into my mind. It was really profoundly moving. Is another thing that happens, I think, in weakness. Like Jesus appeals to us in two ways in the scriptures, right? He is the victorious Son, and we'll celebrate that on Resurrection Sunday, and he's the Son of suffering. And so just as God can make his appeal to us in different ways, at different moments in our lives, sometimes through delivering us from suffering, and other times through coming, crawling down, and parachuting into our suffering with us. So people can represent Christ in different ways, and I think as I reflected back on the week that I just lived, maybe the most profound moment of knowing God's presence to me is I shared during Advent about getting to travel to Istanbul and minister to a group of Iranian house church pastors who are actively oppressed and risking their lives for their faith to do what we're doing here today. And this week, I got a video of 150 Iranian house church pastors praying for me in Farsi. I couldn't understand a single word. I mean, I just hear this multitude of voices, and I just wept and wept and wept because I thought, here's the body of Christ is so amazing. Here's brothers and sisters on the other side of the world meeting me in my suffering. And they're people who are more acquainted with suffering than I will likely ever be. And so I'm so buoyed by their prayers in the midst of my journey.
Thank you. We're midway through Lent. Some of us are feeling tired and disoriented. Some of us are feeling strong and empowered. I'm just curious what your encouragement or counsel would be to us as a community as we're continuing on and heading towards Resurrection Sunday.
Yeah, I think that Lent is primarily about trying to live with deep desires up front in our imagination, right? And so we talked about that and invited you all as a church to a Lenten season of fasting for an increase of faith, and particularly named dreams, power, family, and direction as these four invitations to take a deep desire that is within you and not to let it live up front by attuning your attention to it daily and by not covering over it with lesser loves. And so that's what the fasting or abstinence part is about, is not satiating deep appetites with cheaper hungers. But there's also a tuning desire to it daily, and it's hard to live in concert with deep desire over a long period of time. And the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. And that means that your attentiveness is going to wane. And so I think what I would counsel you in is just to make it a daily practice to reacquaint yourself with that deep desire that began you on the Lenten journey in the first place. And to not beat yourself up about the fact that you're, by the evening, you're going to have a lot less probably attention or energy to that than you did in the morning. That's just part of the human condition. And so daily, reset your intention on this is what I want to live for, this is what I want to remain attentive to, and then allow whatever lesser love you're abstaining from during Lent just to redirect your attention at each moment throughout the day. So maybe, you know, here we are halfway through, maybe you've completely fallen off the wagon. Maybe you don't remember where you began in the first place. Let this be an invitation, not to try to make up for that somehow or anything like that. That has nothing to do with the way of Jesus. Just to instead reacquaint yourself with that desire and start again.
Great. Thank you. One more thing. Yeah. I'm curious, selfishly, what are you praying for us?
Yeah.
The church in this season space that you're in, but also in this Lenten space as we're going after faith.
Yeah, I feel so prayed for by you guys and so loved and supported right now. I think as loved as I've ever felt. So thank you so much for being family to me and to my family. And here's how I'm praying for you. I find myself every morning through the scripture guided to one of those four things, and just interceding for whoever in our church family is praying for a family member of their own, or seeking direction from God, or is fasting for an increase of power, or is trying to dream dreams again. And the main thing that I find myself praying again and again is for those people who might have set out to fast during Lent and have stumbled or fallen somewhere along the way, that the shame that can come from that, or the guilt, would not win in your imagination and your heart, but that you wouldn't waste a second beating yourself up or making up for something or wishing it had been different, but that you would just get up, dust yourself off, and start again that day. And so that those have been my primary prayers, and I hope that God is bringing them to life within you.
Great. Thank you.